once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And I need to tell you a few things about The Personal Wealth Coach. First thing, The Personal Wealth Coach is not only a radio program that shifts from one ear to the other, which causes my brain to go, but it is additionally the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, that is there, and it's not coincidence that the names are the same, because the two dudes who act like principals there act like they know what they're doing here, and so there's that. And the stuff we tell you is not investment advice, despite the fact that the Personal Wealth Coach is a registered investment advisor. The stuff on this radio program that we discuss is educational and should not be considered to be investment advice. Investment advice is given to individuals based on their individual circumstances, and unfortunately, we don't know your circumstances other than you're, for some reason, others on Saturday morning listening to this drivel that we do.
We know that you are slightly insane, or you wouldn't be listening to us right now.
We
are all slightly insane.
We also gather our information from sources we believe and deem to be reliable.
Why did you sing the word deem?
Deem is such a cool word. How often do you say deem?
You're right. It's not a word we use every day.
We only use it in disclosures and disclaimers.
I'm going to start using deem. I'm going to deem things.
I thereby deem thee.
What do you deem about this situation?
We probably ought to reintroduce that word.
It's a good word.
The lawyers use it a lot.
It's a short word. It's not hard to use, and it sounds fancy. Let's use it.
Cool. We use sources we deem.
I deem to
be
a good word.
Reliable and accurate, and we believe to be that to such and so on, but we don't make any warranty or guarantee about the information we present here. Yes,
if we use deem, then we can use deign. We can deign to use it.
We deign to use deem?
We use disdain.
Yes.
Which means we wouldn't use it, so we would deign to use it, but that's kind of like a, all right, I suppose I will, I guess, this, since you insist, I deign to use it.
I disdain not to use deem.
Right. I disdain deign, because we don't use it, but we use disdain. It's disdainful. It's very strange. We don't
pronounce it. We pronounce it like it's got a T in there, disdainful.
Right.
It's actually disdainful.
Well, I think Clorox bleach is disdainful. You see what I did with that? That was a really bad pun. I'm very proud of myself.
I'm supposed to see it, and you said it?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's like saying,
which should I write
it
down?
Is this a radio show or is this a radio program?
We're not showing anything except to each other.
But you asked me to see it.
Do you see what I did?
No, didn't see it at all.
I didn't.
I heard it.
It would have been strange if you'd said yes.
Good.
So you can tell we're in a bit of a mood this morning.
And we're all supposed to tell you, there's something else we're supposed to tell you here.
Yes. None of the talking that we give you, you already said part of this, should be taken as anything other than education.
It should not be deemed to be
right
investment advice, and also should not be deemed have anything to do with Town Square Media.
Right. These are our opinions, even when they're facts.
Now that we've got through that, there's probably some more we could give you.
Yes.
You know, stocks, prices of securities may be higher or lower when bought than when sold, or vice versa. Hey, past performance, no guarantee of future returns. Read the cover before striking.
Yes. Risk-free does not imply actual lack of risk. Meteors and fires still exist.
I guess.
Yeah. This is one of my pet peeves.
Close book before reading.
In academia, in economics, there is this concept of a risk-free position.
Is that economics?
Yes. That's economics.
Economics.
Economics. The risk-free position is supposed to be like U.S. government treasuries or FDIC-backed insured CD that's below the cap on it. So that's supposed to be risk-free. And my answer to that is, well, what about massive invasion or meteor strikes or earthquakes? And people go, well, that's not part of our science. That's somebody else's science.
Well, meanwhile, back at the ranch, the stock market didn't do much, but it did some, and it was significant. The Standard & Poor's 500 stock index for the week. And this week, by the way, is the one ended on the 22nd of June, today being the 23rd. We forgot to give our telephone numbers. It's 254-773-1400 if you want to call in here. And it's the 23rd of June where you are as well as where we are, unless you're on the other side of the international dateline from the United States, in which case it can be the 24th of June and you can call in. But you put a 1 in front of all those numbers then if you're going to call.
Yes.
Okay. Anyway, the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index, which is the one we kind of follow for stocks, is up 0.89% this week. Year-to-date up 3.04%. For 52 weeks, it's up 12.98%. That's all pretty cool. It's interesting that the Dow Jones Industrial Average, though, behaved differently. It was down 2.03% for the week. Year-to-date, the Dow is down 0.56%. Now, that makes it somewhat different, to say the least, from the S&P 500, and there's a reason for that. The Dow contains 30 relatively very large stocks. It no longer contains GE because it got too small. For the first time in 111 years, GE is no longer in the Dow Jones Industrial Average. But the stocks...
That's kind of momentous. It's a big deal.
It's a big deal, and then there's a reason for that, too. We can go into that.
But
there's... And there's a lesson to be learned there, by the way, about the United States economy. What happened to GE very well may be what's happening to the United States economy. We'll go into that. But the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the 30 stocks in that average, tend to be large multinational corporations. And they're the very corporations. I don't know if Cummins Diesel is in there. I don't think it is. But Cummins is a prime example of why people are concerned. Cummins Diesel makes the parts for their diesel engines in the United States.
Right.
They ship them to China where they are assembled in a Cummins Diesel-owned factory.
Right.
And then they ship the finished engine back to the United States where it's put in trucks in the United States. The problem with that is that it looks like Cummins is going to pay a tariff.
Coming and going.
Going into China and a tariff coming out of China, which means that
this could put American businesses out of business.
They basically, because they'll be paying the tariff twice, will no longer have a competitive engine. It's a U.S. company owned in the United States, headquartered in the United States, with the vast majority of its employees in the United States.
The profits kept in the United States.
And it's going to be hit twice with tariffs if the tariff wars continue, and I presume it looks like they're going to.
Yeah.
And it's going to find its engines are no longer competitive, not only on the international market, but in the United States. And it's going to hurt them pretty bad.
On that subject, the tariffs thing, there is a lot of confusion over whether or not tariffs have been actually implemented or not implemented, or if they ever will be implemented. So we're going to say this very quickly. I'm going to go through. There are four sets of tariffs already in place. And plus some from earlier, but the washing machine solar panel tariffs were the first ones. Those are already in place. South Korea and China are feeling that. Tesla's closing down some solar panel construction plants based on the tariff. So this is another American company who's being directly impacted by tariffs put on by an American government. Okay, but steel and aluminum. Those are in place. They are actively being charged. Basically, most of the planet, if they are sending steel or aluminum to the United States, the exceptions are very few. Singapore and South Korea right now, but there's no saying how long that exception will last.
And Argentina. Right.
There's no saying how long that will last because Mexico and Canada were also exempted for a while, and for no particular reason, the exemption was removed. So... just know most of the world's steel costs more when it comes to the United States. Most of the world's aluminum costs more when it comes to the United States. The European Union has instituted, it's already imposed, a 25% tariff on bourbon, orange juice, jeans. That's blue jeans, black jeans, red jeans. People keep saying blue jeans, but blue jeans are not the only kind of jeans anymore.
Canvas pants.
Yes, canvas pants. And other products, there's a 25% tariff there. Mexico has already imposed 20 to 25% tariffs on about $3 billion worth of U.S. goods, including steel, that I find funny, but also pork. So the reason why the steel tariff is because, get this, while we import a lot of steel from Mexico, we also export a lot of steel to Mexico. This is very much like the oil trade or any other major commodity. Our countries don't coordinate with all the companies inside the country to say, are you importing or exporting? You own a company and you need to buy steel and you live on in Texas somewhere. You're likely to be buying steel from Mexico. Somebody in Detroit may be doing steel scrapping business or turning out steel and selling it to companies in Mexico. So it isn't as simple as saying the United States is doing this with their exports, fill in the blank. Because the United States isn't really one entity. It's lots and lots and lots and lots of people, lots and lots and lots and lots of companies. And in any given day, we're both buying and selling steel and aluminum and oil and copper and all the other commodities on the open market. And as I said, all the companies in the United States don't huddle together and say, let's all buy today, let's all sell today. That's not how markets work. So it's really difficult to look at the numbers and figure out, you know, if we say we're net importers of steel, and we are, net meaning that we are importing a lot more steel than we're exporting, that looks dangerous. And I can certainly understand that. It has impacted our trading ability. It's impacted the way we mine for iron and for refining steel. This is something that, if you don't mind for just a moment, I would like to reference back several years ago on this radio program. We talked about alternative energy sources, and alternative being kind of a silly word because the mainstream energy sources at the time was coal and natural gas was coming online. Solar was still out there. Wind was picking up. And we talked specifically about solar. And I talked about how innovation won't be happening in the solar world for quite some time. And it really hasn't happened. Even though we've got lots of new research, it's not being implemented on the practice side. And the reason is because we are subsidizing it. We have these massive tax credits if you go and you buy solar panels. And what that means is that you can get these solar panels and they're better for the environment. That's the reason for the credit. I don't know that that's the best reason to put a tax credit on something, but this is what's happened. It's better for the environment, so you have a solar panel. And people that are looking at that say, hey, that was a good purchase. And it may be. That's not the point here. The point is that the company that's selling the solar panel doesn't have to innovate, doesn't have to compete against other solar panel manufacturers in the same way, because there is such a big incentive that has nothing to do with the quality of their solar panels. It doesn't have anything to do with their efficiency or any of the other things. The government steps in and says, we'll help buy this, which limits competition and limits innovation. That's the carrot side of trade, where the government says we're going to help people buy these things because we think, for whatever reason, and it could have all kinds of different reasons, strategic, ecological, it doesn't really matter. There's a reason the government said we're going to subsidize solar panels. So that limits innovation, limits competition. And what we have is the same solar panels being sold today as far as efficiency numbers go as 20 years ago, even though the ability to create 100% more efficient, which it is, that doesn't mean that there's zero cost in doing it. This is just to keep that out there. But more efficient designs are available and innovated here in the United States. They just aren't being used because there's no cost-benefit reason to do it. They're not going to make a lot more money doing it. They can charge only what they're already charging. They already have their factory set up to do it the way they are now, and they don't have to compete against natural gas or against coal or against any of the other forms of energy because their margins are padded by the government. So let's flip that around the other direction. The government can also make it more difficult for a company to do business. This is the tariff end of things. This is the sin tax side of things. If you have ever looked at the taxes on alcohol and tobacco, or if you're in Colorado on marijuana, it's basically these huge amounts of taxes that are being taken in by the government because the government says these aren't the best things in the world for whatever reason. Again, the reason doesn't matter. Just like the reason why the subsidies on the solar panel doesn't matter. When it comes to how we measure it in the market, what it means is that that makes doing business as a small business very difficult because you've got to, before you get to profit, you've got to eat through all of the extra expenses that aren't there on a different business. Solar panels are difficult for small businesses to get into because the big businesses are creating things that are already massively profitable. And unless you come up with something that is extremely less expensive, you can't compete. And if you think about it from a small business owner standpoint, how do you compete with a big manufacturing firm with a small business unless you spend a lot of money at the front end? That's kind of the opposite of the concept of a small business if you have a lot of money to spend. So both of these acts, the subsidies of solar panels and the tariffs on solar panels, kill small businesses if they're involved in the international trade in any way whatsoever. And most things that we buy or sell have international trade components. Unless you're talking about a toothpick. And even that, most of the time, the toothpicks are coming from Vietnam and Thailand. So have you seen a lot of toothpick manufacturing facilities in the United States? No. There may be some. I don't know of them. But there's international trade associated with almost everything that we do. There's a book. I was showing this to you, old Baldy, just in passing, that I have. It's called Megatrends 2000. And it was given this great futuristic name. It was written in the year 1992. And it was by the people that wrote Megatrends 1990s and then Megatrends 2000. They wrote Megatrends 1990s in the 80s and said, this is what's going to progress in the 80s. These are what we're looking forward to. And in the 90s, what they wrote was that these are the things that we expect to take place in the coming decade up to the year 2000. The things that we expect to take place is a boom in our economy like nothing we have ever seen before based on opening markets and free trade. The Soviet Union had just fallen. The European continent and Asian continents were opening up to trade with our businesses. We had to somehow get over the tariffs and so on that they were imposing, but we were just signing an agreement with Canada so that we could sell to Canada and Canada could sell to us in a free market situation, and it would lead to this great boom in jobs, that there would be loss of jobs in the industrial factories, but that the service jobs, the design jobs, the higher paying jobs would take their place. And that's what we saw happen. And in the book, he said, at the end of this, as happens in every major innovative cycle, we're going to get addicted to the concept of technology, and we will find some new technology that will present itself as the next big thing, and it may be the next big thing, but we're going to overinvest into it. And that, to me, was the prediction of the dot-com bubble. We don't remember that now, but this is the reason why, coming out of the Reagan administration into the first Bush administration, that we saw the kind of innovative and growth-oriented structural shifts. Our companies were able to give better-paying jobs to Americans by outsourcing the low-pay jobs. Now, it wasn't simple and it wasn't easy in many cases. A lot of people lost their jobs in the process, but the training process came along. And the people that had the jobs before, after going through harsh periods of without a job, have better paying jobs now, and we can see those numbers. Fast forward up to the Great Recession, when all this boom and prosperity, we were still extremely much better off than we were in the early 90s, even at the pits of the recession. Fast forward to that point, and we see a lot of jobs disappeared. Now, it didn't have to do with innovation. The jobs disappeared in this case because our currency locked up. But the go-to scapegoat is always new machinery, new innovation. So we say innovation in this case was free trade. The jobs were being lost because of China. The jobs were being lost because we were shipping it overseas.
3 minute stations, 3 minutes to your next Fox News 3030.
I got to make this somehow automatic in here. Okay, so the innovation that took place, the biggest innovation that took place in the 1990s was trade, free trade, open trade. It doesn't get a lot of credit. It got credit in advance. People looked at it in advance and said, this is going to be amazing. If you were part of a business that expanded its marketplace and its ability to create things because of free trade, then you know the value of it. It's really easy to look back on it and say there's nothing, no major change has taken place from free trade. It hasn't brought us anything. It's a bad deal. Unless you really look at the progression of what it brought us. And that's difficult because you can't say that in a soundbite. You can't come out and say free trade is good because one or two words. You got to look at it from a distance and say, what were the benefits? What was the theory behind it? Was the theory proven or disproven? And I would say with a resoundingly clear, the theory was proven. The theory was open free markets increase prosperity, lowers conflict. As soon as you start restricting those marketplaces, you decrease prosperity and you increase conflict. And if you have any doubt about that, just look at what's going on right now. The good news is that we're in a booming economy, and if we're going to do this experiment, now is the time to do it. The bad news is that most people who have looked at this experiment done in the past have a pretty good idea what the outcome is going to be. And that is that in order to win a trade war, the definition of winning a trade war is losing less than your opponents. I don't call that winning. I do call it doing better than other people. And then the last piece here, and I would like your participation in this, old Baldy, if you're up for it. The prisoner's dilemma. Can we do this experiment together?
Okay.
So here's the simplest form, prisoner's dilemma. There's $10 available. If you, we'll use a simple layman's term. If you rat out me, you get all $10. If I rat out you before you rat out me, I get all $10. If we both rat each other out, neither of us get anything. Or maybe we get $1.
Wait a minute. If you do it first and then I do it, you get $10, neither of us get anything?
Let's start at the beginning. You're obviously confused by this, so other people are going to be too. All right. If I rat you out but you cooperate, I get $10. If you rat me out but I'm cooperating with you, you get $10. So people say, well, why doesn't everyone just rat each other out? Well, because if we both rat each other out, neither of us get anything. If we cooperate, both of us cooperate, we each get $5. Okay? This is the behavioral experiment called the prisoner's dilemma. If we cooperate, we each get $5. If we continue to cooperate, we each get $5 indefinitely. If one of us turns on the other while the other one is still trying to cooperate, that one gets $10 while the other gets nothing. And the experiments show again and again that when it's a small group of people that you're talking to and you're giving them this thing and they don't have any animosity toward each other, the general trend is cooperation. They look at it and say, this is a good way of maintaining. We'll each continue to do this. We'll each get $5 every time we do this. Until somebody does it the other way. The first time that happens, the normal outcome is altered drastically. The reality is that then it becomes people ratting each other out constantly and nobody getting anything. continually, because the other one is so afraid that they're going to get ratted out that they rat out at the same time. So trust is vital in any business setting. If you own a business, and this is something that is fundamental to business. If you own a business and you're selling something on a regular basis and you have repeat customers, remember that part, repeat customers, because real estate isn't the same, generally not repeat customers there. If you own a business and you're selling something, you want repeat business. You sell it to them at a price that you want them to feel is a good price so that they come back. That's the prisoner's dilemma. This is good business. If you're trying to sell something at a price that they are not going to come back for, don't expect them to come back. And this is common sense at that point. We've had this long kind of convoluted experiment to tell us what is common sense. And when we're imposing tariffs across the board on item after item after item, and so is everyone else, we've now entered into a time that this is kind of the biggest key. Unless everybody in every country in the world comes and sits down at a table and signs off on it, we're not going to have a simple resolution to this. We have disrupted the trust. That takes a long time to earn back. And maybe we don't want to earn it back. Maybe that's what the president is saying. Maybe it's time. I mean, he was elected based on this concept. And on the concept of immigration, the way he did it. Maybe as Americans, we don't want to be the leaders in trust anymore. But that's really the fundamental issue that we're talking about in business. If you constantly are making moves in a business relationship that are much better for you than for anyone else, people don't want to do business with you anymore. And that's something that I think people can get a hold of, that if you're talking to someone about free trade, this is the fundamental easiest way of looking at it. You don't do business with people that rip you off. Not more than once, because it hurts. And that's kind of the key. Now, I'm done with my soapbox. I know we've got a lot to talk about.
We probably got some commercials to do, too.
Yes. We got some commercials to play. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to join with us, the phone number to call in here is 254-773-1400, and we'll be back on the other side of these commercials.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And where do we go from here? We were talking about the issue of trade wars, but there's a bigger, if you want to go to the big picture in the economy, there's a couple of things going on. Just we'll hit the big picture. We covered this to some degree in the newsletter this week. The International Monetary Fund came out this week with an estimate of long-term U.S. Ability to grow its GDP. And that's it's not a big top secret. The International Monetary Fund came out with 1.4%. The consensus of economists in the United States is 1.8%. Trump administration is saying 3, but they don't give any numbers behind it. Everybody else has their numbers behind it and say, here's where this comes from. And basically, there's two elements in GDP growth. Actually, there's more than that. There's 3. Number one is the number of hours worked, and number two is the output per hour. You say, well, what about machines? Well, there's people working on the machines. So if the machines are doing something and people are supervising them, and people are repairing them or people are maintaining them, then it increases the output per hour worked. So that's an increase in productivity. So we have number of hours worked, we have output per hour, net output out of a company. This so much comes in, so much goes out, I have this many employees, and they each work this many hours, and we can look at that and say, yep, there that is. And we can increase the productivity by doing more work with fewer employees and fewer hours, but that's not been growing but a very small amount, 1.1% typically per year right now. So we got that pretty well nailed down. Now, the other element of GDP is import-export balance. To the degree that we have a negative balance of trade, it subtracts it from the GDP. So there's only three elements in the GDP growth. How much our trade deficit is, or surplus, which we occasionally have.
Right.
How many hours are worked, and how much output per hour each worker is producing. That's GDP in the net. And so those are the three elements. So it's not any secret. And the IMF came up with their numbers, and they basically concluded that we are going to have a 1.4% long-term growth. The 1.8% consensus from economists across the country is pretty close. Their numbers are very similar. The difference between the two of them basically is that the 1.8% really didn't take into account the deficit, the federal deficit, the borrowing of money. The 1.4 says interest rates will go up faster than U.S. economists anticipated, and as a result, the borrowing that the United States has to do to cover its federal deficit, federal budgetary deficit, will go up because we'll have to pay more interest. So really a minor differential, but here's the issue.
Let me throw this in here. When we say 1.8 or 1.4, when they say it, they're not talking about any given year getting that. That's the long-term average.
Right, and it's important to understand this is the average or the mean. Here's the problem. The Atlanta Fed came out this last week and said that they're anticipating the annualized rate of growth in the second quarter of this year to be 4.7%.
Now, that quarter ends in just over a week. Mm-hmm.
The Moody's Economics, which tends to be pretty right on in my experience, is saying 3.5 as they're saying 3.5 to 4, so somewhere in that 3.8%.
And I think we can pretty well agree, most economists agree on this, that we're running between a 3.5 and a 4.2, somewhere in there this quarter.
And Moody's is saying that we very well could get a 3% and maybe a little better GDP growth in 2018.
For the whole year. Right.
So now I want you to say, okay, the same economists are coming out and saying the long-term growth will be 1.8 that are saying a 3% growth in 2018. What does that mean? That means that during 2018, there is a consensus across the board that the United States will be growing much faster. The GDP, the product, the gross domestic product of the United States, will be growing much faster than can be sustained. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean we generally drop back slowly to 1.8%? No, because we're using up resources. It's kind of like if you walk, let's just say that you're in pretty good shape and you can walk 3 miles an hour for all day.
Right.
And but you decide that you're going to sprint for a while. Well, after you sprint for a while, your walking will slow back to well below 3 miles an hour. You'll probably slow back to 1 mile an hour for the following hour, and you might have to just sit down and rest for a while. And this is what happens in any economic system or any system. It's what happened to GE. During Jack Welch's time, GE practiced Six Sigma, it's called, to the max.
Right.
And he supercharged the company to make it, at the time, it became the largest corporation in the world. It was very effective, turned out great profits, and stripped the workforce. IBM did the same thing. They stripped their workforce out. They made things, they found a way to do things less expensively. They basically squeezed the system to get maximum return in the short term, and in both cases went into long-term decline.
Stifled their own innovation.
And oddly enough, that's exactly the same philosophy that's being applied in the United States today. By doing this tax cut and by increasing spending, yes, we're goosing the economy into overdrive. We're turbocharging the economy for a year, maybe 2 years at the most. And then along the way, we will start slamming into what's called capacity utilization. Yes.
Yeah, this is an easy way of looking at it, too. By the way, just as a side note, we're both happy that we got the tax cuts. Personally, and for our clients, we look at this and say, this is great. The long-term dilemma for the United States is the problem. If you're talking about growth, and think of a household, if you get a bonus this year of $10,000 and you made $90,000 last year, you made $90,000 this year, but you get a bonus of $10,000. We'll even make it $100,000 last year, $100,000 this year, and you get a bonus of $10,000. So that's a 10% growth in your salary. Well, next year, if they continue the bonus at the same amount, you don't get a growth in your salary anymore. It's the same as you had this year. So when you're looking at the charts and you say the growth in salary was a 10% growth in salary this year, isn't that great? And any person should look at it and say, I don't expect to get that same kind of a raise next year. I don't think I'm going to get another 10% boost next year because my productivity hasn't come up enough for me to continually get a 10% boost. Some people get that. If they're doing more productivity, they get pay raises regularly in a perfect situation. So when we have a boost from a tax cut, this is a big boost. It's a big boost to corporations. It gave them a huge amount of extra earnings. It's a small boost to individuals, but very welcome. Don't expect the same extra boost next year. We have the same tax law for next year as we do for this year. So that growth that we're seeing this year, this is the year we expect to see the growth that we're going to have. If we were looking at productivity, which is the hours worked, number of items made per hour, if we boosted that, then there's a really good reason for us to continue to get good growth numbers on that. If we continue to boost productivity, if we get better at what we're doing, just like the individual case, then expect us to be able to continue to run faster for longer. But we haven't boosted that with this act. So we shouldn't expect this to be a permanent growth rate. And that's just the most simple way of approaching it. And I realize it was slightly complicated to say it the most simple way. It's part of the problem with politics is that statements like this don't have good sound bites. You guys have to be slightly insane to listen through our whole convoluted explanation of what's going on. Hopefully it turns some lights on, though. Hopefully it clicks to say, oh, that's where this growth is coming from and why we don't expect to see it continue for huge amounts into the future.
And when it comes to gross domestic product, remember I told you that the trade deficit subtracts from the gross domestic product.
Right.
Starting probably next year, but certainly the year after, the current spending and tax bills will be generating $1 trillion annual deficits. Now, one of the problems that we're encountering in the system right now is much of that money is now being borrowed from overseas. And so at some point, we'll be borrowing $1 trillion a year from outside the United States. Well, that's an import. That's $1 trillion worth of imports. And that $1 trillion worth of imports is going to dramatically have a negative effect on our balance of trade situation, which lowers the GDP. And then that's going to, if interest rates continue to rise, which most indicators suggest they will, then the cost of that debt that's already on the books will begin to rise, and we'll be paying more and more interest and borrowing more and more money from overseas. So what we've done, what Congress and the president have done, is juice the economy for 2018. It may drift into 2019, which hopefully, and again,
I think it will. Yeah.
We've actually, there'll probably be a boost in the economy in 2019, but and there was no question as to the why behind that. There were several congressmen and certainly staffers and members of the administration who said the purpose was to retain. Well, the president said it this week. He wanted the immigration bill to not even be considered because he felt like after the 2018, after the House, after the elections this year, they would have more votes in the House and be able to pass the more strict immigration bill that failed. And that failed when they tried to pass it this last week.
Well, they suspended the vote. They didn't actually vote on it.
No, the second one they didn't vote on. The first one they voted on, and it just fell pretty quickly.
Ah, okay.
The first one was the one that was put forward by the Freedom Caucus, and they only got the Freedom Caucus voting for it, which was a pretty draconian bill that didn't provide for citizenship for the Dreamers, and it was a pretty right wing bill.
Just as a side note, when we talk about words that have impact, labeling a group of people Dreamers makes it really hard to cut them out. When even the Republicans are calling them Dreamers, it doesn't look good. This is one of those things where they haven't had their marketing guys or gals look at this and say, what do we call them besides Dreamers? Because that's kind of the chosen term. It's really hard to dislike Dreamers.
Yeah, and so the president believes that the tax cuts and the additional spending will so innervate the economy that they will, that the Republicans will, instead of traditionally, as they have, whatever party in the House in midterm elections has the White House, loses typically seats in the White House at the midterms, and they're trying to reverse that. And whether they will or not, we'll know after November of this year. But
this is our prediction. In November of this year, we will know the outcome.
Right.
Right.
But the point is that that tax cut, as much as we like it temporarily, combined with the rather significant third of a trillion dollar increased spending for this year, is put a lot of juice in the economy, but it's all borrowed money, and much of it is being borrowed from overseas. So what we're looking at going down the road is this tremendous juicing, or whatever you wanted, or turbocharging of the economy in the short term. But the thing I think we all have to be aware of, the laws of economics don't go away just because you juice the economy in the short term. And that means reversion of the mean rears its ugly head. It won't. That means that around 2020 or 2021, the economy doesn't drop back to its sustainable rate of 1.8%, which I think is an accurate one, or 1.4%. It drops far enough to make up for the excesses it did before, which means, like
reversion
GE,
to the mean.
GE has become an insignificant company because it keeps losing money. That's it in a nutshell. And why does it lose money? Because in the process of juicing itself years in Jack Welch's years, it burned out a lot of the quality elements of the company, and it has been deteriorating ever since. And Jeff Immelt did everything he could to try to turn it around. But once this deterioration sets in, once the morale is broken, once you got rid of enough people and everybody else that are running terrified that if they make a single mistake or if there's a single bump in the road, they're going to get laid off, then you see the company begin to deteriorate. And there's a pattern that fits national economies that works the same way. You can juice it up in the short term, but you'll pay for it in the long term. It's far better to try to run along at the sustainable rate and then take a look at why the sustainable rate is low. And the sustainable rate is low for a very simple reason. As a nation, we're getting older. We have one of the lowest labor participation rates of any developed nation, and there's a reason we have a labor participation rate this low, and I was looking at the data that finally came in on that. We have a really phenomenal number of people who with prison records, and there's many, many jobs. If you have a prison record, you can't get the job. And we have a phenomenal number of people with for prescription reasons are on opioid medication, and many of them are addicted.
Yeah, and let me throw this in here because this is a bipartisan thing. There aren't that many bipartisan things to discuss at the moment. Even things that 5 years ago we would have said, this is never going to be political. Free trade? No, this is just accepted. Let's come forward to one thing that is bipartisan, and that is the marijuana legalization concept. When I say it's bipartisan, if you look at the numbers, if you look at the Republicans, for instance, in the state house, the legislation branch of our state in Texas. Texas is one of the most conservative states in the union. But if you look at the numbers just of the House representatives in Austin of who supports a medical marijuana bill, you'll find that the vast majority in the 70% range of House representatives that are Republicans are for this, and the numbers are very similar for the Democrats. So when we look at a significant proportion of our economy, our workforce, that have nonviolent offenses that have to do with something that we pretty much agree across the board shouldn't be an offense, but it's still the law, it's time to change the law. And I think we can all see it in this case and say, okay, this makes sense. Another case would be prohibition of alcohol. You know, this is often compared with marijuana. We come back to alcohol and say there was a reason why alcohol was made illegal. It was made illegal because there was this big new voting group, women. They didn't have a vote before, that hugely were not participants in alcohol. They just got to deal with drunk husbands because there were rules against women drinking in public, which is kind of hard to consider today. It's hard to imagine. Talk about difficulty. Women can't drink, but men can. And then the law changed. Nobody can drink. And then the law changed again. Everybody can drink. Now, we still have vestigial pieces of that, but why did the law change back? Why did it change to now people can drink? Because we realized that the vast majority of people were okay with the moderate consumption of alcohol. It needs to be regulated, needs to be taken care of. That's how good laws get made. When we look at what the vast majority of people think on how to live comfortably in a society, if you make a law around that cultural value, that's a good law. If you make a law that nobody follows, it's a bad law. If you make a law that the vast majority of people say, yes, I follow that, no problem, good law. Vast majority of people breaking a law, bad law. This is as simple as can be because the people are the government. We are a representative democracy. We elect our government, and they're answerable to their constituents, as much as people talk about that not being the case. So just that's my end of that. I wanted to kind of give that tie off.
There's so what we're looking at is, and we've talked about this a lot in the newsletter that we publish, but this one of the things to be aware of is there's a couple of issues that are out there floating around in the economy with regard to where we're going in the intermediate term. One is, this year and next year probably will be excellent years for doing almost anything. The tax cuts are there, and unfortunately most people aren't aware of them. It's amazing to us the number of people who are not aware of the fact that they probably won't itemize this year. And they're talking about their tax deductions and itemization, and when we look at the amount of itemization they had last year and you look at the new standard deduction,
they're not going to itemize
this year.
Yeah.
And this is, we haven't seen the effects of, so there's a lot of the effects of the tax bill and the spending bill we haven't seen yet. So those are still coming down the road. But at the same time, there's this block. In other words, it's basically the engine is running at what the engines are running, what we used to call military, full military power in when I flew. And when you run at full military power, you shorten the life expectancy of the engine. You shorten the time between now and the time that they're going to have to overhaul the engine, and you have to record it. And you basically are saying, we're running this as an emergency. We're going to run it at above full speed for a period of time, and we'll pay the price later, which is kind of neat, and it's a lot of fun if you're in Star Wars or Star Trek, but it's not so fun if you're running a company or if you're running a national economy. The backside to that is that because of the trade wars that are no longer threatened but are in fact going into effect and look like we're going to get tit for tat, and everything is indicative now that we're going to see steadily rising prices and steadily lowering commerce because of the tariffs, and that is causing the 10-year Treasury note to decline in its yield, which says, well, that's cool, I can get a cheaper mortgage, except for the fact you can't get a cheaper mortgage because housing starts are collapsing because we have put tariffs on wood from Canada, which makes it very difficult to get the wood. And the wood is more expensive, which means they have to raise the price for the house. It starts to get a little complicated at this point. But the bottom line to it is, short term, the Federal Reserve is raising interest rates. Long, intermediate term, 10 years, the the 10-year Treasury note is declining because the market is considering that our future economic outcome may not be so good if we're going to do trade wars. When the short-term end gets higher than the long-term end, so far in history, 18 months later, we have a recession.
Right.
So we are out of time for this hour. You have been listening to the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the telephone number to call, if you'd like to talk to us off the air or leave a message on the weekend or talk to live people during the week, is 254-947-1111.
You can also reach us toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, and listen to podcasts of this radio program and many others going back through the years. You can read our newsletter. You can read our philosophy, see our made-for-radio faces. Kind of the wrap-up for the hour, this is a good time. Be a grasshopper, or don't be a grasshopper, be an ant.